Plunk to me explained why he hadn't included Plunkett.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Okay.
He thought it wasn't invented, the Teflon wasn't invented until after the deadline of his book.
That's what he told me also.
Yeah.
I think he went up to 1960.
Yeah.
And he had just put it in his mind that it was later, and so he hadn't gone beyond that. Well,
of course, since it happened in 1938, it's an inexcusable. And since Teflon was all over the place in the scientific literature.
But when Plunkett discovered it, there was no immediate use for it.
Oh, yeah.
And he was moved out into the tetraethyl lead plant as a promotion.
Oh?
At the time, there was the unknown material with absolutely no use versus an increased demand for tetraethyl lead.
Mm-hmm.
And so within 6 months of the discovery, he was moved and never did go back to
the... I didn't know that.
But he has the patent on it.
Yeah.
And DuPont has taken very good care of him.
Uh-huh.
In fact, whenever he goes to a meeting, they still pay his expenses to the
I'll
meeting.
Be damn. How old is he?
70.
Well, he must be Florey's age.
Yes. Mid-70s.
Huh.
Mid-70s.
I've never met him.
Very, very fine individual. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he visited Chalk. He was in Philadelphia for a AAAS meeting in the end of May, and I got him to stop at Chalk. And as a result of that visit, DuPont has reproduced a magnificent blow-up of the laboratory pages from his lab notebook for the discovery of Teflon.
Oh, yeah.
So we have it, and we're getting it framed now to hang.
Hmm.
Well, let me just indicate again, this is Jim Boning, the Center for History of Chemistry, speaking with Dr. Ray Boyer in his office at MMI in Midland on 19th of August, 1986. Dr. Boyer, we mentioned in some letters back and forth that there was another Ray Boyer that to which there's a very fascinating story. Would you tell me about that, please?
Oh, I thought, no. I first heard about this Canadian chemist by the name of Raymond Boyer when there was a newspaper article published saying that he had been giving Canadian wartime secrets to the Soviets, and it gave some of the details in this particular newspaper account, which appeared in 1946. I never saw any more about it and had pretty much forgotten the entire incident until I went to Europe in the spring of 1952. It was my first trip abroad, and I sailed on the Dutch ship, the New Amsterdam. We had a wonderful time. I thoroughly enjoyed all the people I ran into, and I then had to leave the boat at Southampton, and while the boat went on to Holland, we transferred to a tender after going through customs on the New Amsterdam. Immigration seemed just a formality because people were going through the line as fast as they could show their passports and get them stamped. And of course, this was British Immigration Service. But when I came up, I could see that there was some delay. There's some hesitation about me, even some consultation among several of them, and I was asked to step out of line. Well, I was thoroughly puzzled by this at the time. And then after we got on to the tender, I was asked to sit up in the very front deck seats. They were benches, as a matter of fact, with a member who said he was, with a man who said he was from Scotland Yard. And without explaining why, he began interrogating me about my background, and the main thrust of it seemed to be connected with my record as far as going into Canada was concerned. Well, of course, I had been to Canada many times because Dow Chemical Company had a production plant in Sarnia and offices in Toronto, and of course I knew a number of the Dow Canada people and some Dow Canada scientists, and I had even gone to Canada one time to give a lecture on glass transitions in copolymers. So I faithfully related these different experiences without hesitation, and at first without any clue of where this was all leading. But then sometime toward the end of the interview, and apparently from things that were said or questions asked, I began to get the connection with the other Raymond Boyer. And it was a little bit upsetting. In fact, I guess quite a bit upsetting to have a thing like this happen on my very first trip to Europe. To England, too. I proceeded to London by train and registered at the Dorchester Hotel. And I was so upset that as soon as I could get established in the hotel room, I went down to the street and wanted to walk across the street to visit the Dow Corning offices, which were just 20 or 30 feet away from the hotel on a side street. And I knew some of the Dow Corning people, the English representatives, and I knew they had an office right there. And I needed a shoulder to somebody to lean on, because I was absolutely upset, and I did talk to one of the people there who had visited Midland a number of times. Well, he tended to make rather light of the thing and to assure me that nothing was really going to happen to me, and that I should stop worrying. But when I went back to the hotel, there was a very suspicious-looking man there. He was who seemed to be taking quite an interest in me. And that further caused me some discomfort. But, well, almost overnight, I forgot it. Pretty much, and really stopped worrying about it. Well, later on that same trip, I went on to France to attend a scientific meeting and give a lecture there, and eventually stayed in a hotel in Paris. And there I was interviewed by some official who began asking me questions about my background. And it was rather clear that it had to be connected with this Raymond Boyer, the Canadian Raymond Boyer incident. Nothing really happened, and I had an enjoyable first visit to Midland. I then went back to England by boat train, and in the first class compartment, seated opposite me were two American ladies, and I got into a conversation with them. In fact, I knew the husband of one of the ladies, as it turned out. I knew his name through science, and we had a very enjoyable conversation all the way to Calais. And then we were on the boat for the crossing, and when we got back on the train, at Dover, I thought I had the same seat again, but the ladies were missing. I never saw them again. But seating opposite me was a rather distinguished-looking gentleman who seemed to take more than unusual interest in me. We never exchanged any words all the way to London, and I never saw him again. But I think there was no question of some kind of surveillance. I always imagined that they would hope that I would try to get away or do something throw them off the trail. But of course I didn't, and I went about my normal business and had all sorts of contacts there, and the whole thing then blew away. A few years later, I was in Zurich, and I got visited one day in the hotel room by a man who was some kind of official of the police force, and he too began questioning me. And of course these were all well-mannered sessions, and no attempt at intimidation or anything like that. But this man had a trick that I think was a dead giveaway. We'd be talking along in English, and he would speak quite good, quite understandable English. And then all of a sudden, he'd drop some French phrase into the conversation. And, of course, the Canadian Raymond Boyer from Montreal was presumably quite capable of speaking French. And so I realized that this was an attempt to trick me. Since I never spoke French in my life, I couldn't fall for the thing. And eventually the whole episode passed. Now, I went to Russia in 1960 for the big UPAC meeting there, the first one in the Soviet Union, and to the best of my knowledge, there was no no such interviews or anything like that in the Soviet Union. And of course, I naturally supposed that after all, they knew where he was, and they knew that I was not the other Raymond Boyer. The whole thing seemed to die out until we went to the UPAC meeting in Budapest in 1969. And we were sitting in a restaurant one night, my wife and I, in a booth with two other strangers across from us, young ladies as I recall. And somewhere through the meal or during the meal, a man, a well-dressed man, came and sat down at our booth, forcing himself in on the two ladies across from us and making things rather crowded. Well, his excuse was that they were about through eating. And the ladies did leave, and he stayed on behind and talked a lot. We conversed. He spoke excellent English. He was Hungarian. And, well, it all seemed so natural that I didn't think anything of it at the time. But that night I got back to the hotel, and there was some kind of reception for the newly arrived guests. And here was this man, Herr Schneider, I think was his name. He hadn't said anything about being any part of the meeting, but it just seemed that that he was somehow keeping track of me. And I ran into him several times. During the meeting that week, he kept popping up at places where we were, but then the whole thing ended like all the others had. Well, in 1972, I received the Swinburne Award from the Plastics Institute of Great Britain, and went over there to receive the reward and present a lecture. And the lecture, incidentally, was held in the famous room at the Royal Society where the Friday lectures had been given and so on. And it was a social occasion as much as anything, because a lot of wives were there, and I had anticipated this and had actually prepared a rather semi-scientific lecture. Then after the lecture, there was a banquet. And it turned out that at the conclusion of the banquet, I was expected to make some kind of remarks, of a, just general remarks, whatever. And so, sort of on the spur of the moment, without too much preparation, well, I naturally thanked the committee, my host, for our wonderful accommodations in London at the Brown Hotel and the big suite we had and everything else. And then I said, my reception this time was certainly far different than it was on my first trip to England. And I recounted this experience with Scotland Yard. Well, Cecil Bawn was sitting at our table, at the head table, and as I was telling this story, he was nodding his head. And it turned out that he knew the Canadian Raymond Boyer, because Cecil was in explosives work during the war. And in that connection, he got to meet this professor from Montreal who was also in explosives. And he said something to me across the table while I was still on my feet, and I said, well, Cecil has just confirmed my story about the existence of the other Raymond Boyer. And Cecil knew that this man had in fact betrayed these secrets as the newspaper had stated. So that was the end of the story.
You don't know if he stayed, this other Raymond Boyer stayed in Canada, or did he?
Oh, he disappeared.
He disappeared then.
Oh, no. From anything I could find out, he had simply disappeared, and that's why when a man carrying a passport shows up in England with the name of Raymond Boyer, Scotland Yard was on it right away. He, I assume, was a wanted criminal. And since this happened in France and Switzerland and Budapest, but never in the Soviet Union, I think the evidence was pretty clear that he had indeed disappeared into the Soviet Union. And he probably was not an important enough man to ever to make the headlines. So,
did he have access to Canadian secrets through the explosives work?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's what that newspaper clipping said. He gave them to somebody else who gave them to the Russians, wasn't it? He was a member of parliament, I think I read that.
Yes. Fred Rose, communist member of parliament for transmission to the Soviet Russia.
Mm-hmm.
He was ordered to appear on March 28th. Well, thank you very much. Is there anything else while we have the tape recorder on that we should talk about? I had indicated I wanted to talk about Paul Florey, and you've got most of that documented in letters and in your other files. Would you recount for me again the story of the the European meeting when you were giving the paper and he was chairing the session?
Yes. Well, I had been invited to the University of Manchester for a several-day symposium in the spring of 1960. As an invited speaker, expected to give a plenary or one-hour lecture on a subject of my choice. And I've got to get the date straight. What did I tell you before? 1970. I think I said 60, didn't I? Well, I goofed on that.
The Welsh conference meeting was Corradini. Corradini was in 67.
Yeah, that's what I got to thinking about. And also, when I thought about my subject matter that I talked about that day, it was an outgrowth of my review article on the multiple transitions in polymers. And that had made quite an impact in England. So I have to change this date, I'm sorry, to 1970.
Okay.
Yes, because that ties everything together. Now, the three speakers, well, on this particular morning when I spoke, there were two other speakers. The first was Professor Rehagi from Clausthal in West Germany. Speaker number two was Dr. John Hoffman, who was then at the National Bureau of Standards in Washington. And I was the final speaker of the morning. And, of course, I was then at Dow Chemical Company. Rehagi gave a lecture on the thermodynamics of the glass transition, a topic which he had published on before and talked about before, but it was quite an elegant lecture, and it was the sort of thing that Florey liked to do, the kind of thing that Florey himself would tend to do in tackling such a problem with rigorous thermodynamic considerations and so on. Hoffman talked about some of his dielectric studies, and particularly the alpha transition, which is a pre-melting kind of transition, for which he and I think Lauritsen were working out the theoretical concepts. The main part of my lecture was concerned with the multiple transition behavior of atactic polystyrene, which I had been studying in great detail for about 5 years. And that pretty well took up most of my allotted time. Then I said I wanted to discuss a subject very briefly, one that whose implications I didn't fully understand, but it concerned a rule of thumb for which I had made a certain reputation, namely to the effect that the glass transition temperature for many polymers seemed to occur at about two-thirds of the melting temperature when both temperatures were expressed in Kelvin. And I pointed out that after I had published several papers documenting this finding, I learned that Charles Bunn, who was then at ICI in the research laboratory, had predicted such a relationship some years earlier, in fact in around 1952, and I